discussion we had last time, where we kind of generally went through the wars before we got to this war, gave you a chance to do any pondering or soul searching in between the time we met and now. Come to any great conclusions or observations or realizations about us, the nation, war itself, anything? Well, darn. I was hoping you would. Maybe you did, but it's just not bubbled up enough to words to share. So we are on 13:14, the top of the second page, is that right? 15, okay.
I have a question.
Okay.
When we went into Bosnia...
Oh, yeah, we never got to that. That's right, we never did that one.
We went in there because of the problem with Croatians, the Serbs, you know, the Slavs, I mean, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But, was that ever actually a war?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because you brought that up and I forgot to ever address it. Start that off by saying Ann Coulter, who you may know and may like or may not like, she's pretty fiery, extreme right-wing conservative, and likes to really stick it to liberals whenever she can, was asked about why she criticized going into Bosnia to free people, but now justifies the involvement in Iraq on the grounds that we must free people from Saddam. And her answer was, we had no strategic interests in Bosnia, but we do have oil interests in the Middle East. And so when the other side is saying that about Clinton, that gives you some perspective there, that the war in Bosnia really was not for any specific strategic or commercial advantage. It really had with it the nature of being a humanitarian exercise. And it wasn't Clinton who wanted to do that. I mean, he did after he was persuaded. It was Madeleine Albright who was the person that really pushed him and said, we missed our chance in Rwanda and should have moved. We can't make a second mistake. We've got to go in this direction. Of course, having been from Czechoslovakia and her family being Holocaust survivors, she had a personal feeling for that. So it was clearly you might say, humanitarian police action as opposed to any kind of a long extended war. Now, in the process of doing that, we screwed up and bombed the Chinese embassy and nearly started a war with them, but that wasn't on purpose. But that was the Bosnian one has two very specific things to do about it. This thing about being a humanitarian effort more so than for national interests. And the second thing, I can remember in the summer of 98 when I was down in San Antonio grading AP papers, which I'll never go back and do. That was hell. But when I was down there doing that with one of the other instructors from Chicago, we talked about this situation, which had just been resolved, and he pointed out that this was the first time that a major conflict was settled completely by air power rather than having to commit ground forces, and other than a nuclear attack. But and that was what was significant, was that without committing any ground troops, we were able to actually pull off the humanitarian move that it wasn't for our strategic interest. So the Bosnian campaign, with its mistakes and problems, fits into one of those categories where I'd say we're a nation we could be proud of. Not everything we did, but the purpose behind it. Is that what you would...
Yeah. I mean, I was just not curious.
So then why do people... Well, I answered that question. Why do people like Ann Coulter not like it? She just admitted straight out, unless we have something to gain out of it, we shouldn't be helping other people. So that's how I translate her. She would have loved the Spanish-American War, this one, because we definitely went in for more than just humanitarianism. We had gain going on.
I'll leave it. Lots of times that right-wing conservative people, you know, adhere to very Judeo-Christian ethics.
They claim they do, yes.
You know, so you would think that,
mercy and compassion would be.
You know, she would have been more supportive of it.
Well, then again, another way to come at this, and we're all guilty of this, and that is political realism. And that is that once your side's in power, you do everything you can to explain and defend why they were right with what they did. And then when the other side's in, you do everything you can to criticize and attack. I'm sure there's things that President Bush has done that's quite... If Clinton had done the same thing, I would have been praising it because Bush did it. I was criticizing it, and I wasn't being really fair. I was just taking sides partisan-wise. So it could be well that she didn't want to get caught praising Clinton. Even when Rush Limbaugh agreed with Clinton, he wouldn't even say it that way, agreed with the NAFTA treaty, he made sure he wanted to specify that he was not agreeing with Clinton, that even Clinton could do something right by accident with NAFTA, which I don't think NAFTA was so right. But anyway, that is why they will think that way. And then not to be attacking right-wing Christians, because we may be surrounded by them as we speak. Sometimes it amazes me how, well, I won't even say right-wing Christians, certain religious groups, left and right, Christian and not, will cherry-pick what they want from their faith as a way of defending their political positions. And what I'm thinking is, they've already made up their mind politically and socially and ethically which way they believe, so then they go looking for the justification to not feel guilty. We'll probably all do that. Well, enough of my pontificating. How about back to this? So thank you for the question, Donna. I like that. Don't get those questions in high school. I like that. Appreciate that.
You do or don't?
Don't. Oh, every once in a while you do, and then you get all excited and you praise the student, and then everybody gives him the dirty look and he never asks again. She never asks again. Yeah. Well, for me, it'll help if I go back to the top of the page and mention what the buildup that's going on in here is that the reality is that from 96 through 97, Wehler's counterinsurgency campaign had not produced positive results that had created more of a backlash in Cuba, so Spain had recalled him. That's in our previous sheet at the bottom. And so what was being told to the American public through the yellow press journalists was old news that was already out of way and being fabricated and being exaggerated beyond what was such. And this letter by De La Maza, I guess you could say if 13 and 14 had not occurred, if the letter had not been written or had not been captured and published, and if the ship had not blown up, things would have just kind of fizzled out and dissipated. But there's a way sometimes how just certain few factors karmically fall, and they happened here within 6 days apart. De La Maza's letter is published by the Hearst's New York World Journal, rather, New York Journal. And then this gunboat explodes, giving Hearst not just something to fabricate, but something truly that did occur to exaggerate and put blame on the Spanish. So what's happened here is that the American public opinion is moving quickly in the direction of wanting a war with Spain, primarily for jingoistic feeling reasons, but also from the perspective of somebody needs to protect people in our hemisphere from these nasty old Europeans, especially the Spanish. Yes? Well, it's pretty obvious that his people were monitoring everything going on in Havana illegally, and that probably was not the only letter that was opened and searched and looked at. This is just the juiciest one to publish. And is that a means that how incompetent was the Spanish handling their postal services? But they well may have been bribed to allow them to look at these letters. So it's a good question, though. Spain was, or McKinley, trying to avoid war. This is between 14 and 15 here. Trying to avoid war, McKinley sends a private memo to the Spanish government saying it's an ultimatum, demanding that you free Cuba, cease hostilities, which they already had done, cease hostilities and free Cuba, and accept some kind of quasi-American protectorate over Cuba. And the Spanish government, knowing they couldn't win a war, replied positive, yes, to the American minister in Spain. Says accepted 2 days too late, but I've in reading recently, I've discovered that there's two parts to that story. One is Spain actually accepted on April 10th, the day before war was declared, but by all the time this information could be relayed from the American minister back to McKinley, it was 2 days too late. The war declaration had already occurred. But McKinley actually knew about the April 10th reply before Congress officially declared war. Well, that's the great question. And this is not a parallel thing, but I was thinking about when Bush moved forces into the Middle East, and someone asked, what if Saddam Hussein does step down from power? Well, that would have solved it. Or if Saddam is right when he said he turned over the weapons. The Bush response was not one of, well, then we've got it solved without a war. He didn't say that. He said, once you've got troops on an active standby basis and material in place, it's very bad to bring people back out of a war zone. It's better to let them go. That wasn't exactly his wording, but the essence of it was he'd made up his mind to go regardless. That's not exactly the same thing as McKinley, but what McKinley was told by his cabinet was that since Congress declares war, and they were pretty strict in those days about the actual official line between a Congress declares a war before a president can actually commit troops into action. There was a much greater degree of constitutional questionability about just committing troops without support. So since Congress declares war, if you don't get ahead of the game here and actually be seeking for the war declaration, they'll declare it anyway. It'll fall upon you to carry it out, but you will be politically dead in 1900 for running for re-election if you are behind the Congress and behind the public. So he was torn between trying to resolve the problem without going to war, but also being pressured and told, if you're not leading the charge for war, you won't be re-elected in 1900. So that's kind of the... He folded to the pressures. He folded to the pressures that the De La Letter said he would. So the letter that made Americans mad enough to go to war was true, that we wanted to go to war, and he didn't want to leave us.
So we were just picking a fight.
Pretty much so, yeah. That's why I put this war in the category of like the Mexican-American War or our current war as being one where motives were not solely for defending ourselves from attack and not solely for the purpose of liberating people, but the advantages that come with going to war, which we're going to look at down in 17 in a second anyway. We might see some parallels there. And the other question might arise, once it was clear that Spain had agreed, couldn't they have declared the war and then within a week say, victory, you know, Spain's already, you know, agreed to our ultimatum, just the threat of American powers made the difference. That could have been something that could have made McKinley look good. He could have bragged and said just threat alone was enough to make him cave. But he
was then Congress's ulterior motive in keeping the war going then?
Well, let's do 16 and 17 and see if that answers it, because I've been trying to lead it in the direction of exactly what you're wondering is. A week after the war was declared, Congress made an addenda or an addition, an amendment to the war declaration called the Teller Amendment, sponsored for the senator who put it forward. The Teller Amendment declared that this war was for liberating Cubans and we had no design on annexing Cuba. That this war is only to liberate or free Cubans. There is no intent to annex Cuba. So if that's sincere, what direction is Congress trying to suggest to the country we're going? Yeah, we're the good guy. We're not the European imperialists that just take things over for our own and ulterior reasons, that this is going to be a war. Once the Cubans are freed, we're out. But the question mark is at the end of the sincerity, because I just don't think that was, I think it was tongue-in-cheek. It may have been a struggle, actually, in the Congress between those who really feared the imperialists and wanted to try to hamstring the imperialists from going further. And so they just went ahead and voted for it, because, as you know, it doesn't matter what you say a war is for. Once you get it started, there's all kinds of changes you can add to it and where you can go with it. So once you get a war begun, it's just amazing all the lack of restraints that appear in this situation. And John Hay, in item 17, who was Secretary of State for McKinley and later for Roosevelt, John Hay had been a personal secretary in his younger years for Abraham Lincoln before the assassination. But Secretary of State now in 1898, he was joyful about the war declaration and announced that it was a splendid little war. Now let's look at all the possible meanings that could be ascribed to that. I mean, I would think war is the worst thing you can do. If murder or killing is wrong, then killing many people is even worse. So even if it's in self-defense, it ought to be something that you have to kill many people in self-defense. There ought to be a great reluctance and sadness that you were karmically pushed into the position to have to do that. Yet he describes it as a splendid little war. So what might be the many ways he means it?
Is there not much mortality?
Yes, that's the first one. It was a chance to do two things at once. Beat up on a European power and show we are equal to the Europeans, and to do it to a weak one that's easy to beat. Spain was by far the most dilapidated of the leftover European empires. So here was a chance to prove ourselves against Europeans with one that would be easy to beat, and they were easy to beat. So there is that jingoistic feeling of wanting to prove oneself in an easy to win struggle. What else might it be? Let's ask this. When was the last time the United States was in a war? Civil, before this, civil war, each other. So this is the first conflict in which we're on the same side together rather than the festering sores of... It's still 30 years after the Civil War, and there are people who remember it well. In fact, young veterans of the Civil War are purposely put in from the South. They're put in charge of command of this war to show that Southerners will be commanding Northerners, and this is a united nation, and the waving of the bloody shirt can be put behind us. We're all on one side. So it was a national unity opportunity, as well as a chance to jingoistically prove ourselves against the Europeans in an easy war. And then if the Teller Amendment is not sincere to some people, and we go back to the thinkings of Lodge, Roosevelt, Beveridge, and Mahan, what other opportunities does this war offer? Yes, yes, very much so. A chance to put our armored metal fleet into action, and again, test it against the Europeans. It is a chance also to take over foreign bases. If Mahan suggests a strong navy with the island bases around the world protects our interests, here's a chance to do it. And not just in the Caribbean. There will be Spanish possessions in the Pacific, which will be gained out of this. The Philippines, we'll see that too. So that doesn't sound very much like the Teller Amendment. But again, it's a case of how sincere was it to start with, and once wars get started, where are the restraints if there are any? So this is where I see in the Spanish-American... Of course, I'm always doing this. Years before, I saw everything paralleled Vietnam. Now suddenly everything... Then for a while, everything paralleled the Gulf War, and now it parallels the Iraq War. So is that my partisan realism trying to make everything seem like it's there or what? But I just see these parallels going on that we... When we got into the current war, it was seemingly for defense and also to liberate people, but there's no hiding what a more convenient thing it would be to have greater control over the oil of the Middle East, not have it in the hands of Islamic fundamentalists, which if you watch a lot of frontline shows, the neoconservatives had that plan in mind well before Bush was elected. They went to Clinton with these plans, and Clinton ignored him, so they went to candidate Bush and said there ought to be a greater control of standardization of U.S. policy towards the Middle East to protect their oil reserves. So their reserves, it would be considered ours. So I think that there is a similar attitude here that we can gain strategically while at the same time do something morally good, and that is free Cubans. So that's what the Splendid Little War comment by Hay meant for him and for many other people. 18. In regards to it being a war that didn't suffer that many casualties, we'll find that while 5,000 Americans die from disease-related incidences, only 500 die, which is still a lot, but I mean 500 die due to battle deaths. And the Spanish's inefficiency and lack of professionalism probably is what kept those numbers so low on the battle side. Theodore Roosevelt plays a role in two different ways in this war. In item 19, we haven't talked yet about Roosevelt much. We'll say more about him when we get him to be president over in somewhere. Let me find where that's going to be. He'll become... Oh, goodness. He'll become president later on the sheet. He'll show up somewhere, surely. Anyway, a little background about Roosevelt before we get to that. I wonder how that disappeared. But he came from upper-class family. The Roosevelt family's roots, both Theodore and Franklin, and Eleanor, for that matter, all their roots go back to the time when the wealthy Dutch established patroonships in New Netherlands before independence. So they really trace their roots back before independence, but to Dutch origins. They were a family that made great wealth in the early 19th century. I hate to say how, because I'm such a fan of Franklin Roosevelt, but through selling opium to the Chinese in the early 19th century. Yeah, they were, but the effects of opium in the early 19th century weren't as well known, so it's possible they were. Yeah, that could well happen. They're thinking, yeah. And they surely weren't the biggest sellers either. They were had a diversified portfolio. That wasn't the only way they made money.
Was opium legal in China at that time?
Yes. Uh-huh. Now, the Chinese government, after the 1860s, does its best, after the Second Opium War, to try to outlaw it. But the British forced the Chinese to continue to buy the opium. But that's not us, that's the British that did that. So. And by that time period, a lot of American people were out of the business, realizing who they were allying with and the English on this. But anyway, I'm not trying to criticize the Roosevelts, because Franklin Roosevelt, to me, has got that halo on there, and I just worship him too much to criticize him. But anyway, Theodore, and he had this kind of patrician responsible attitude. I think that the phrase we used before was noblesse oblige, the idea that people of wealth have an obligation to society, that a great free market situation like America makes it possible for them to get rich, and so they owe a debt of gratitude back. And they lived that way. They tried to not be too ostentatious with their wealth. They were quite philanthropic, charitable towards society. Another feature that some of these people felt, Theodore felt for sure, was that people with the better fortune and the better education, Harvard graduates like him, had a responsibility to lead society. Didn't have a choice, had a responsibility. It was thrust upon him. And so he always felt that he had a duty in business and society and in government to lead. As a Harvard student, unlike most of the upper elite who made the gentleman C's, he actually worked for his grades and made A's, and was quite a scholar. He ended up writing 40 different books on history, much of it on Western history, won a Nobel Pulitzer Prize in history writing. So he was definitely a responsible, sincere person. He was a mugwump. Remember the mugwumps, what they did? Republicans that criticized Blaine and voted for Cleveland, which would have been kind of like Democrats voting for Nader, I guess, at some point. Just the feeling. So Roosevelt always felt himself to be someone who either fate or God or society had chosen to be a leader. He was serving at the time the war broke out as Assistant Secretary of the Navy in Item 19.
I have a question. Is that just kind of a Roosevelt thing?
Franklin would later hold that post during the Woodrow Wilson term. For two of Roosevelt's it is. It's interesting that they both held that, both become presidents. I'll probably never come back to this, so let me just stay on this a little bit about Roosevelt's health. And that was, he was sickly and asthmatic when he was young, and was given advice to do a lot of strenuous exercise and outdoor activity as a way of improving his health, which he did, and I don't know if that's actually good for health, but he did so, and that was what improved his condition. He attributed to that. And so he always kind of judged people by not what they were by birth, but what they became by their own efforts. He was a real pull-yourself-up-by-your-own-bootstraps person. Of course, he was born into wealth and was wealthy all his life, but he also felt like the rigorous outdoor life proved people. He made a lot of friends with ranchers and Native Americans and boxers and police, and he liked to hang around rugged people, and that really paid off later when he organized a volunteer commando group that we'll talk about. So a lot of personal experiences for Roosevelt shape his thinking and attitude of leadership later. Well, anyway, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he will do something on February 25th which will have long-range consequences. He notices that the Secretary of the Navy is out of the office taking care of personal business that morning, so he jumps on the communications telegraph systems and sends a message to the commander of the American fleet in the Pacific, George Dewey, George Dewey was the commander of the American Pacific Fleet, which was at this time stationed in visiting Hong Kong, China, and informed them that When they hear of a war declaration, which should come soon, of course it does in April, they're to move as quickly as possible to the Philippines and engage in battle with the Spanish. Which is exactly what happens. Once the news is fully clearly conveyed to Dewey, he moves to the Philippines and on May 1st, 1898, engages in a battle with the Spanish Navy. Every Spanish ship is sunk. 175 Spanish sailors die. One American dies due to heat stroke. So what a contrast between the American armored fleet and the wooden Spanish fleet. But defeating the Spanish on the oceans is one thing. There's still the need to secure the islands, and so George Dewey then makes a deal with Filipino revolutionary leader Emilio Aguinaldo, listed here in 19. Now, maybe we should pause a second and say, wait a minute, I thought we were here freeing Cubans. Well, how do we free Cubans over in the Philippines? How do we find bin Laden in Iraq? Well, there's a linkage. What's the linkage? Yeah, it's Spanish. You defeat Spanish somewhere, you defeat Spanish everywhere, and you prevent the fleet from coming back to the Caribbean, you have a better chance of winning. And while you're there, it's conveniently possible to acquire island bases to protect your China trade, very much so. And because Roosevelt was a great believer in Mahan's book. So yeah, that was the purpose, was to gain influence and control over a far-flung island port, the Philippines. Emilio Aguinaldo was the, and at that time, the leader of the Filipino Revolutionary Forces. This is something totally not on the test, and I don't know that much about, but I just get a kick out of looking at it sometimes. He was a disciple of a Philippine literary rebel named Jose Rizal, and in many ways, Jose Rizal, R-I-Z-A-L, is to the Philippines like Jose Marti was for the Cubans, and that is, both became martyrs, killed around the same time, 1895. Both inspired others to rebel against the Spanish. So what I'm getting at is there is a movement in the Philippines somewhat similar. I mean, it wasn't in rebellion, but they saw the opportunity and moved with American help. There was a movement in the Philippines against the Spanish like there was in Cuba against the Spanish. And Aguinaldo becomes the one who inherits this movement and negotiates with Dewey. Dewey and Aguinaldo will meet aboard ship, and nothing is on paper, but the way Aguinaldo will put it is that Dewey explains, "It is obvious from the Teller resolution we're not out to annex land. We're here to help liberate you from the Spanish. Therefore, what can we do to defeat the Spanish land forces?" And Aguinaldo says, "Well, we can combine my guerrilla forces, Caputin, can help you out." So, revolutionary rebellion movement. Insurgency is what I say. And it's successful. Aguinaldo and Dewey working together do completely defeat the Spanish and take control of the Philippines. Now back in the Caribbean, in item 20, American land forces are placed under the command of General Leonard Wood. But one of the units that serves under Wood is a volunteer commando group organized by Theodore Roosevelt. Roosevelt didn't want to go through the regular military and work his way slowly up the rank. He wouldn't be where he wanted to be until maybe World War I. So he decides instead to call in the markers of all the friends he knows and put together an elite volunteer group. They'll call it the Rough Riders, and offer their services to Wood, who accepts it. Accepts it because of his social station, but also because they needed the help. Now, they didn't necessarily need the manpower, because on the day that the war on Spain was declared and announced in the newspapers, it is said that 1 million Americans stormed induction centers to join. So it's not like they were without necessary troops. They may have been without necessary trained troops. But that figure alone, I mean, 1 million people in 1898, what would that translate into by today's population standards? I'm not really sure. Could be. Could well be. So that day in December 8th, 1941, are the 2 days when the most people wanted to suddenly join up. So why are so many people wanting to join up to this war? Maybe to get paid, maybe to get a job. I mean, it's a few years after the end of the Panic of 1893, so it's not economic hard times, but maybe money opportunities for Paul.
A lot of it had to do with people's perception of battle. Like back in those days, there were a lot of illicit stuff that betrayed.
That's true. That's very true.
Even honor, and a lot of
those young enough to not remember how their relatives went through the Civil War.
Right. They're not going to make it worse, so they didn't know
about it. In fact, that you brought that up. We had a discussion at the high school that I thought was of interest. Now, it's not going to really, what I'm going to say now is not well proven by the fact that the Civil War is so recent to this, but throughout America's wars, when a foreign force attacked America, when did we ever suffer great losses on contiguous Western Hemispheric soil? When was the last time we did? Before 9/11. Before the attack on New York and the Pentagon, when did we see large numbers of people armed? On the contiguous, I've tried to build my question carefully here. That's it? War 1815, when they burned the Capitol in Washington, or the War of 1812, that was really it. in World War II, this figure may surprise you. Civilians living in America at the time of World War II, the number killed by foreign forces, 6. 6 people killed by a balloon bomb that the Japanese sent over the Pacific that blew up in an Oregon forest and killed a preacher and 5 Sunday school kids. That's the number. How many did the Russians lose in that war? 20 million civilians, not even counting military forces. So as a country, we've not had that kind of loss ever occur. We are just oblivious to what it means to suffer. Now, the Civil War, we did from each other. But as far as foreign attacks, we've not known that. So what you say makes it very possible that it's easy for people to see war as a glorious thing. Soldiers suffer, no doubt. But civilians, we don't have to. And the criticism today is that if we are in a war, we sure don't act like it, we sure don't seem like it, we don't have to make sacrifices. That's pretty much true. Even the worst of them, the World War II, we didn't have to. So that makes it easy to see why people could associate glory with these things rather than suffering that can come from it. Anyway, Roosevelt organizes this group called the Rough Riders. He put this thing together in a place some of you may have been to if you visited San Antonio and the Alamo and the Riverwalk area. Do you remember, as you face the Alamo, the miniature hotel to the right? If you've been there? There's a famous bar there, the miniature bar of the miniature hotel. That is where Roosevelt did the recruiting for everybody in the United States to join the Rough Riders. And, of course, the hotel has a lot of museum-like displays of Roosevelt's uniforms and sword and things like that. But the bar itself is pretty famous because it shows where people first met and joined up. And there's a big chunk of the bar, kind of like a triangular section that is the woods out and placed right back in, because not of Roosevelt's doing, but somebody else famous in history attacked that bar. Ever heard of Terry Nation? Terry Nation was an anti-saloon prohibitionist woman who had an alcoholic, abusive husband, and she went on a campaign to close all saloons. And the way she did it was she would just show up at the saloons and start axing up the bars until they arrested her. She did it over and over throughout the United States. And the miniature bar in San Antonio has a big slice in it that Terry Nation did, and it's also famous for the recruitment of the Rough Riders. So, pretty good dark beer too. So, if you're in San Antonio, that's what you want to see: is the miniature hotel, miniature bar. Again, as I said before, he drew from ranchers that he'd met, Native Americans that he'd known, police, boxers, a variety of folk that he knew personally, but pretty select few hundred that came out of the thousands that joined up. They were sent to Cuba. They never did actually ride horses, as their name would imply, because the horses showed up after they fought their battles. But on foot, they stormed both San Juan and Kettle Hills, and Roosevelt took real risks and nearly was killed in both battles. And from that, he parlayed that into political advantage, running for governor of New York as soon as he got back, and within 2 years' time, would become the vice president. Well, the war was I wouldn't say easy, but a sure success for the Americans in the summer of 1898. And by December of 1898, there was already a peace treaty negotiating its conclusion in Item 21, Paris Peace Treaty. And it includes these provisions. And almost always when I have a list of anything that's like a treaty list or list of causes or list of laws or something of that nature, almost always the test question is going to be all the following except question. So give you that clue now. Whenever I have a list of things, I like those questions. So here are the following provisions that were part of the Paris Peace Treaty. The first, and the one that should have been first, is Cuban independence recognized by Spain, which it, as we know, already was on April 10th recognized, but now officially recognized together. The islands of Guam in the Pacific and Puerto Rico in the Caribbean, as well as Wake, which is not on here, but I'll add that, Wake in the Pacific, were taken from Spain and made American territories. And the Philippines,
Wake, another Pacific island, not too far. W-H-A-E.
Conclude is going on. It's the island bases. It's the refueling stations to you get to the Far East. And keep in mind, we had a very good, vigorous going trade with China and later Japan going in this area. So there's purpose and reason here. And the Philippines would be taken from the Spanish, and the Spanish would be paid, whether they wanted it or not, $20 million for the transfer. It does sound familiar. When we talked in the previous class about the Mexican War, the taking of California and Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado area for $15 million. And let me throw this out here. Most often, whenever the United States has acquired land from a foreign power, either through negotiations or through winning a war, there's been some kind of money arrangement going on. Either they owed us money and we won't make them pay us, we'd say, or we'd actually pay the money for the land. And there's another example. Paid Spain $20 million for the Philippines.
Wrong.
Yes. Leaving the Filipinos out of this discussion for just a second, you know, what's the way you'd assess this?
We gave way too much for it. We gave $15 million for all the rest.
Well, that wasn't what I was thinking, but that may have been the criticism of the day, too. The paying at all for land that is taken. I mean, isn't that like, say, for example, I walk into a store to buy something and the guy decides, no, I'm not selling anymore, I'm closing up, and I pull a gun and say, no, you're selling, whether you like it or not. And we get into a fight and I force it out of him and I leave money on the counter and walk off.
It's just to try to make it look like we're not a bad guy.
Maybe we actually don't feel like we're a bad guy. If I left on the counter the price he was originally asking, we just had a transaction on. That's all right. I didn't steal anything, right? Because he got compensation. I could think that way. They may not be. But that comes back to, why did Europeans not do that, and why do we do that?
Because we want to be seen as the nice guy.
Well, there's probably something a little deeper about being the nice guy, and that is what...
We want to look better than the Europeans.
Well... True, because we respect what they don't respect, and that's what?
Yeah, we still want our reward.
Property. You can't take property away from people. That's a fundamental Enlightenment principle that the Fifth Amendment embodies. There must be some kind of eminent domain, just compensation for the loss of property. So whether they wanted to make the exchange or not, if you pay them, you have essentially not destroyed their property rights. They get the money for the exchange of the land. Don't you feel that way when you lost half your backyard for a highway? No, the war was well over, and if they had not agreed to the treaty, we would have forced it upon them anyway. So by the time the December treaty was going on, it wasn't a case of not stop fighting. It was just a case of making it look better, making it official. But I think that there are probably many who felt like, if you kind of put this all together, someone feels like once the Philippines are taken from the Spanish, then what can happen to them? Yes, they can be modernized, they can be democratized, they can be turned into Protestants, and for those who didn't even know it, they could be turned into Christians because they were Catholics for 400-500 years. So it's a better life for the Filipinos. Their economy can improve, their jungle disease problems can be resolved, which actually were resolved through American involvement. It's better for the Philippines. The Spanish get something out of it. They're a fallen down empire and can't take care of the Philippines anyway. We can use it conveniently as basis to protect our China trade. It's a win-win situation for everybody. That's probably how a lot of people felt about it.
So have we always kind of like forced our culture down base growth that we take over? I mean, like we did in California, they were U.S. citizens, whether they liked it or not.
I don't want to just say yes. There's got to be some historic examples of not. No, I think we haven't. Like, for example, the end of World War I. Here the Europeans are stealing colonies from the losers and demanding repair money. We didn't take any colonies or any money. into World War II, we occupy the losing powers and eventually free them and let the Germans and Japanese have their own independent governments again, as long as they're anti-Russian. So there are examples where we could have been worse, and we weren't. But I do think the Spanish-American War and the Mexican-American War, too, were greed and aggrandizement was a little higher than human rights.
What do you think we'll pay for Iraq?
Oh. Well, that kind of reminds me of at the end of the Mexican War, there was a great fight and debate about whether annexing all of Mexico. And the only reason we didn't is because the diplomat and general who were down there rushed a treaty to the opposition in the Senate before Polk could do anything about it. But that would have been probably the same situation, annexing all of Mexico and dealing with the insurgencies that would have followed from that. So, good question. More of the treaty here. These first parts for the Philippines wasn't met with that much opposition. It was pretty much, even liberal critics of the war felt like that this would probably be better off for those people. But the Philippine part did trigger a pretty raging debate. And two sides arose with people recruiting on both sides for and against the annexation. In 23, we see those who organized what was called the Anti-Imperialist League, who opposed this part of the treaty. Not all of the treaty, but that part. There's a lot more names here than the ones you see listed, but like Mark Twain was in this group also. Strangely enough, Mark Twain was in favor of the war the day it started, believing it would truly liberate Cubans. And then when he saw the land grabbing going on, he became quite a cynical critic of it. Jane Addams of the Hull House was outspoken in her attack on this. Grover Cleveland, who had shown himself to be anti-imperialist when the Hawaiians were first taken over, joins the group. Samuel Gompers is also a member. What might have been his motivation? I mean, he may have had sincere motives like the Declaration of Independence, but I'm thinking just he's a labor leader, head of the American Federation of Labor. So his opposition is probably based on what? Yeah, to avoid the influx of cheap labor, which will drive wages down for American workers. And that kind of leads us to another thought, and that is, well, I'll wait till 25 when I get to that. I'll wait till 25.
They opposed the Philippines being part of this treaty.
Being annexed by the United States, yes. Not even if you didn't even pay for it, they were opposed to it. They just thought it was essentially wrong. In fact, their workings are that... I don't know how many million, but there were millions of Filipinos I at one time knew, did not agree to this. In fact, we'll find following the treaty, they will engage in a near 3-year war of insurgency against us. From 1900 to 1903, they'll be fighting, feeling double-crossed by the treaty. So this is not what they want. And these opponents to the treaty point this out, that this is a complete violation of the spirit of the United States. The spirit is based on consent of the governed, right to make your own rulers, right to disagree with unjust authority, and here we're forcing this on these people. I guess the other islands, the population is so small, there wasn't as much of a feeling about that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Why was it such a big deal about the Philippines but not the other islands?
I think because it's almost like the way people felt about the acquisition of the West. There were so few Indians that they didn't feel that guilty about annexing them. But if you'd had like, if I'm correct, I think there's 15 million Filipinos at this time. If you had 15 million Indians not wanting to be annexed, that would make it a different issue rather than 4,000 or something of that nature.
Yeah,
but
the base of the Philippines is so much smaller than the West.
That's true. Well, there's the good parallel. Does our acquisition to the West follow the same patterns of acquisition to the far, far West into the Orient, I guess? And parallels can be made.
Do you think Gompers
I'm not so much thinking he's afraid that people of different, although that's going to come into our discussion, but different ethnic background would rise the social ladder so much as it would just be this constant surplus labor that keeps wages low all the time so that there'd be no bargaining power for the unions. That's what I'm thinking. Those who favored the treaty are probably not surprising to us. Lodge, Roosevelt, Strong, Mahan, people we've already mentioned before what their reasons were, whether it's to spread culture or to spread strategic influence and commercial ports and opportunities. it fits Mahan's formula perfectly to have these far-flung island bases. The Philippines would really make a great base for the trade in China, and I haven't talked about that much, but the China trade, while they did mention the selling of opium, the China trade had been going strong since the 1840s. And in the 1890s, what we haven't come to, but we will a little later, is that the trade in China seemed to be very threatened by greater encroachment of the Europeans and the Japanese. And like I said, we'll say more about this later, but there was a fear that China may be so gobbled up by outsiders that American markets would just disappear. So by having these bases in the Philippines, that gave us a stronger hand on saying to the Europeans and the Japanese, don't carve up China. And we'll talk about that a little later. Racism became racist ideology became a debate for both sides, for and against annexation. Why would that be? How could you be racist and be for annexation? Well, it's pretty easy to be racist, but...
Was it strictly just they were looking for land and not the people? Like land value?
No, they're actually arguing it's good for the people. This will improve the people. So maybe the word I'm looking for is more like condescensious or being, you know, there's a word I'm missing here, patriarchal. That's what it is. It's the idea that our little brown brothers need to be uplifted. In fact, to use a quote from McKinley, which is here in item 26, McKinley, when asked about how he felt about the treaty, said that he had thought about it deeply. In fact, one night he spent the whole night praying to God about what to do about this treaty, and that eventually somewhere in the middle of the night it came to him. God had spoken to him and said that it would be cowardly to return the Philippines back to the Spanish. It would be bad for business, I don't know how that figures in, to give to the Germans. So we had no choice but to uplift, civilize, and Christianize the Filipinos. Of course, as we pointed out before, they had been Catholic since the 1500s, so that Christianized part's a little out of kilter. Well, then again, that might be the case. You might be thinking that from the old way of looking at things, both are heretics, so maybe Catholics aren't Christians, he was thinking. But I don't really think that's where he's going with it, because when... Dewey first attacked the Philippines and McKinley was informed about it. It is said that he had to get out a globe and have somebody show him where on the globe. He didn't even know it was in the Pacific where the Philippines were. So I think this is more of just a pretty naive thinking. But it does say something. It's that attitude, again, of we have some kind of mission to bring other people up to American standards. I mean, here we are, a nation that felt ourselves pure from the defilement of Europe, but we found ourselves still culturally arrogant in that feeling, whether it's towards Europe or towards other countries. So that's one of the ways we can say is that racism had it. Of course, it's obvious why racism would work in reverse, and that is, think about it for a second. If you annex these as territories, are the people living in those territories going to become U.S. citizens? This is after the 14th Amendment. If they become U.S. citizens, then what goes with that?
The right to vote.
That's right. Well, the right to vote is a little tricky there. Let's say rights. We'll stay away from the vague ones. Rights that states can't take away, rights that the U.S. government can't take away. Traditionally, is it our right to travel from state to state as we wish? So could they travel from the Philippines or Puerto Rico to America and marry your daughter and live next door and take your job? So there was the great argument there, was that if these people are going to be treated as equals, maybe we shouldn't annex them. Well, the way they came to the conclusion to solve that problem was, let's annex them and not let them be citizens. Exactly what they did. And that constituted some court fights. There was about a 10-year struggle in the federal courts, in the Supreme Court, before it was finally concluded that the people who live in these annexed territories, they are under American jurisdiction, but they are not U.S. citizens. Now, that would change for the Filipinos and for the Puerto Ricans in 1916. Of course, Philippines is independent now, but for Puerto Ricans, it's still true there. U.S. citizens can travel as they so wish. Well, the election of 1900, this is going to be a rematch between Bryan and McKinley. As you know, Bryan will run for president three times, 1896, 1900, and 1908, losing all three times. It's said that Bryan spoke in Fort Smith back in 1898 at the what is now the Darby High School Auditorium, which was, I guess, at one time the biggest auditorium in the western part of the state. Twice he came to Fort Smith as a traveling lecturer for the Chautauqua movement. Bryan starts off this campaign opposing the annexation of the Philippines in the spirit of the people in item 23. And of course, the treaty's already ratified and over. But he's saying that part of the treaty was wrong and should be reversed, that the Filipinos should be able to rule themselves. Went down, plummeted quickly in the public opinion polls after making that remark. So then he tries to reverse himself by saying, okay, I am for annexation now, only because we can be good tutors and free them quickly. No one else could train them in democracy like we could, so let's get them trained and get them going quickly. Stayed down in the polls. So then he abandoned the whole Philippine discussion and said, we need to coin silver. And went real hard on the silver coinage and, of course, lost the election. So a little bit out of touch with the issues. And McKinley really had everything going for him for re-election. The gold discoveries up in the Klondike in Alaska had kick-started the economy after the Panic of 1893, so things were revving well from 1897-98 onward. And he's successful in foreign policy. I mean, candidates and re-electing presidents like to have either a good economy or a good foreign policy. When you got it both, it's kind of hard to lose, and McKinley did. Won that election. Item 28. Look at the after effects of the conflict here. Leonard Wood would be left in charge of a military occupation of Cuba until a civilian government could be put in place. In 1901, Congress makes an adjustment to Cuban independence known as the Platt Amendment. How many people have seen Fast Times at Ridgemont High? Do you remember this scene where Mr. Han says, who remembers the Platt Amendment? Nobody does. Nobody remembers the scene in the movie either. People don't often remember the Platt Amendment. They miss it a lot on the test. I don't know why, but that's why I ask in the movie. Platt Amendment. Here's what it includes. It says, this is an amendment to the treaty, by the way, one that Spain didn't have any voice on. We just make a treaty and later make amendments to it. Said that Cuba will be independent, yes, but with an asterisk next to it. It's going to be a U.S. protectorate. We're going to exert military protection over Cuba against any possible European invasions. Cuba will be a U.S. protectorate. It'll be under our defense. Part two. Cuba cannot borrow money from European banks, default on the loans, and get invaded. I mean, that's not word for word what it says, but that's taking all the language down simple. Cuba could not borrow money from European banks, default on the loans, and then get invaded for doing so. Now, that may sound strange, but that was going on in the Caribbean at this time. From 1898 to about 1906, a large number of Central and South American nations were doing exactly that. They'd borrow money from these banks, refuse to pay back the money. The Italians and the French and the British would get all wired up and say, let's just go invade and collect. Now, if they did do that, would that violate anything? Well, like say, let's leave Cuba totally out of story. Let's say Argentina borrows money from Italy and then thumbs their nose at Italy and says, we're not paying it back. So Italy says, well, our Navy's going to come take over your country and we'll sap the money out of you. Is that our affair of any point? Yes, it is. It is. That's, we have... That's right. We haven't done that, but we did it in our past class, yeah, that in the 1820s, the United States put forth a proclamation saying that no European colonies can be established in the Western Hemisphere. Now, we hadn't had any real test of that. The closest test we had was in the Civil War when the French took over Mexico, and we were kind of tied up, couldn't do anything about that. But now we're back, we're strong, we're the hemispheric police persons, and we're protecting our little brown brothers from Europeans, and so there really was. That's what they would say. They would say that they meant that. And so the idea that these nations running the risk of being invaded means that, however reluctantly, the U.S. has to step in and do something. Cuba's not going to do that. So that's why that's in the Platt Amendment. We're not going to have to deal with Cubans triggering a war for us.
So does that keep them from borrowing from European banks at all?
Don't they'll borrow from American banks. That's the other side of that provision, that in addition to not creating a diplomatic mess, it'll also give American bankers a market. And the third part of the Platt Amendment, the first two, by the way, I want to say, were thrown out in 1934. In 1934, those first two parts of the Platt Amendment were finally dropped. But the third part still exists today, 1934. The third part was never repealed, and that is, we declare we have a right to a naval base in Cuba, and it's Guantanamo Bay. Guantanamo Bay naval base in Cuba was acquired here in 1901. And obviously without Cuban agreement. You may wonder how Castro, during his during his communist years, which are still now, I guess, in 1959, yeah, how Castro has felt about our presence in Guantanamo. Well, yeah, he feels it's an imperialist takeover, it's an act of war, and what we have done with Castro is what we did with Cuban rulers before that. We send them a check every year for rent. And Castro tears the check up every year and says, I don't take money from capitalist dogs. So that's how that works. That's true, but if he took the money, then he'd be acknowledging that we have a deal. Not really defending him, but it's just... And that may help explain why the Guantanamo Bay was used to put the prisoners at the War on Terror, because it's a convenient place that doesn't necessarily... It falls under jurisdiction, but it doesn't fall under the traditional civilian Bill of Rights jurisdiction. But it goes back to this point in time. Of course, as we said prior to the war, one of the reasons that there was a desire to establish a military base somewhere, Cuba being a good place, is to protect for a future canal, which will be built. Let's do 29 and we can make a transition here. I should have put in item 23 of those who opposed the treaty were Emilio Aguinaldo and 15 million Filipinos should have been in that lineup. They sure weren't amused at all. In fact, they engaged in a rebellion against the U.S. And it was a very, very bloody rebellion. Longer time, more lives lost, more money spent than the Spanish-American War. And counterinsurgency tactics, very cruel ones, used to suppress the Philippine Revolution there would later be used to fight in Vietnam with. You may have heard the expression to run amok. That comes from this time period when Filipino revolutionaries would engage in such terrifying tactics that the American soldiers said they were said to have run amok. Or that was actually a Philippine phrase, amok. But in 3 years' time, it was finally quelled. And by 1905, 1906, peace was secured, and by 1910, all elements of the rebellion had vanished, which is pretty surprising for how severe it was in the beginning. And the reasons, possibly, was that the higher standard of living that the Americans brought. They did get rid of the jungle diseases. They did create employment. They brought modern conveniences. And so in many, many ways, life became physically better for the Filipinos than they'd ever known. Under the leadership of the civilian governor, William Howard Taft, who would later be president. And maybe I'll close tonight with a scene from a movie that... And I'm not at all defending imperialism in the Philippines, but I think it was Life of Brian, a strange film by Monty Python Group. And there's a scene where a group of... I think it's the Judean People's Front, a group of anti-Roman Jewish revolutionaries are meeting in making their plans. And the joke of the movie is they spend more time bitching about the Romans than they ever do actually going out and fighting. So they're in one of their sessions talking about the Romans, and they say, what have the Romans ever done for us? Aqueducts. Okay, aqueducts. Roads. Okay, roads. Schools. Okay, schools. Peaceful at night. Yes. Good jobs. Okay, you got that. And after they get through listing all the reasons they hate the Romans, they kind of lose their steam on hating the Romans. In some degree, it reminds me of the Philippine occupation in 1910. So we'll come back to 30 when we return.